Open Source is sponsored by listeners like you. Pitch in to keep the world's first podcast going strong. 15 years and counting. Find us at patreon.com/radioopensource. And thank you. I'm Christopher Lydon. This is Open Source. What you will not hear at the big political conventions this month is that both parties have worked hand in hand for 40 years now to shift so much wealth to the very rich as to change the culture and character, perhaps the fate of our country. We've heard pieces of this story before, tax cut after tax cut, the greed is good ideology, the 600 billionaires that now own more wealth than 200 million Americans do altogether. Kurt Anderson's telling is different, mainly because he makes it personal. He has been a sprightly, innovative, and successful journalist, founder of the satirical Spy magazine, also Studio 360 on public radio, for most of the period we're talking about. But his new book is told almost as confession. These are the stories he missed or misunderstood, alarms he didn't hear, social and psychological prices of economic unfairness and political scheming, the connections he didn't make. I know the feeling, writing the stories and missing the point. So he and I are sharing the pleasures of connecting dots and the professional agony of seeing the big picture too late. Kurt Anderson's book is titled Evil Geniuses, subtitled The Unmaking of America, A Recent History. He sums it up toward the end as an account of how we let a powerful clique and its enablers turn a quintessentially modern and reasonably fair political economy that led the world into a freakishly old-fashioned and unfair one. Kurt Anderson, this is a remarkable book coming right at the peak of our political season. And it starts in the 70s with the guy I covered for the New York Times, Jimmy Carter. Something about handing the country over to its money.
Before that, a little bit before that, really 1970, 71, when I, as a kid in high school, and I think most liberals and most Democrats thought, oh, this is an irreversible place we are. This point of progress and increasing equality and everything, this can't go back. Yes, we might, you know, oh, this guy Reagan, he's a freak. He's never going to be elected president. And oh, this Jimmy Carter fellow, which 1971, nobody had heard of outside of Georgia. Yes, he's a bit centrist and maybe a bit more conservative, but we're still all on the same glorious left-heading progressive path, aren't we?
The cultural premises are important. A country dedicated to the future, the new world, and innovative, inclusive, optimistic, sharing, not perfect equality by a long shot, especially in the racial dimension, but we believed in that stuff.
We did. And, you know, we had just been through, again, in 1970, 71, 72. I mean, yes, there was the McGovern debacle, but this sense of this excitingly new place that embodied new and reached to be new in every possible way. And, oh, let's give the 18-year-olds the vote and let's pass the Equal Rights Amendment and look at all these new wonderful things that America is and has invented and so forth. And as I call it, we were at peak new, and then suddenly we weren't.
Two dimensions here. There's a cultural piece. We went into sort of rear view nostalgia, Ronald Reagan especially, and Trump trumps it with Make America Great Again. What dream world he's summoning is not quite clear. But more particularly and more urgently, this matter of money, enshrining wealth and giving it a break, the tax cut industry, and it goes on under both parties forever. The infallible markets, the irrelevance of government, the indulgence of businesses one by one. How did it reach the dimensions that you describe, including Warren Buffett saying, we are in a class war and we're winning, the money people, and it's wrong?
It didn't just happen. It was a class war. And I remember when my fellow Omahan Warren Buffett said that in 2005, 2006, I thought, well, Warren is being his usual frank but amusing self. Well, it was more literally true that this was a class war than I ever realized at the time, that it was being waged and planned and strategized in 1970 and 71 and throughout the 70s with all of the think tanks built. And then in the 80s with a new right-wing media establishment built and further built through the 90s, and the CEOs of the largest corporations getting together and creating a kind of capitalist Politburo of a kind that really hadn't existed, certainly since the original robber barons and the Morgans and so forth a century earlier had existed. Again, there was no one room where the nine original evil geniuses got together. But what I realized after doing the research and the look back, and wow, how did I miss that?
Yeah, but it was almost nine guys in a room. People are sort of familiar with Lewis Powell, smart business lawyer working for the Business Roundtable. This is all well known. He writes a memo in the 70s that, wait a sec, we're being had by the labor movement. We've got to fight back and take the thing over. And it's steady progress from then on. From Nixon time, and he put Lewis Powell on the Supreme Court. It's never stopped. I still marvel that we slept through it.
Yes, we did indeed sleep through it. And because liberalism, broadly construed, culturally and politically and economically even, seemed, as we now say, such a hegemon, so in control, that what do we have to worry about if, oh, look, Milton Friedman gets a Nobel Prize. That's fine. Oh, look, PBS gives Milton Friedman a TV show. Fine. We were magnanimous in our true liberalism, allowing it to happen. And then in the Democrats in Washington, the new Democrats in Washington, like Gary Hart and the rest, sure, let's meet them halfway. Of course, it's a free market country and we can have free market solutions to social problems. And looking back, and I'd forgotten or maybe didn't even recognize it as alarming as it was at the time, that Gary Hart, whom I was very fond of and felt great affinity with,
me too,
literally said, FDR, the New Deal, Bourgeois, bah, the evil geniuses. The opposition had their eye on this prize of low taxes, more money and as much money as possible for the rich, and as much power for big business as possible, and no mission creep.
I'm just struck in retrospect how big the pattern is and how I missed significant details, or I didn't see them as part of a whole. Jimmy Carter, running in Pennsylvania for the Democratic nomination in 1976, and he's meeting with mine workers, and they want black lung benefits, and he's fighting them and resisting. And finally he says, they chose to be miners.
Yeah.
Bob Schrum quit that campaign at that moment. He said, no, I can't be part of this. But he got the nomination. Hubert Humphrey never entered it and then died of cancer. Ted Kennedy sat it out. But to my taste, the Democratic Party never went back to the miners.
Well, exactly. I mean, the Democratic Party really decided, starting with Carter and obviously through the Democratic Leadership Conference and Bill Clinton, that they would not be a, in the British sense, a labor party, that they would not be a party of the economic left, that they would not represent a distinct economic vision from the Republicans at the time. And instead, the hills they would die on and the battles they would fight hard were about race and abortion and all these worthy causes, but the economics, we don't disagree fundamentally with the Republicans. And that was the decision that was made collectively, more or less, starting in the late 70s and lasting for a couple of generations, which of course had the effect of making the miners of the world, the manufacturing workers of America, think like, why am I a Democrat anymore if they're really on my economic issues, my union issues and all the rest, not really different than the Republicans?
To the point of 40 years now without a pay raise for the median worker. Since 1980, the income of the wealthiest 1% has tripled. And around the Great Recession time, Obama time, between George W. Bush and Obama, the top 1% got 95% of the income growth. I mean, this sounds like a recipe for a revolution or else sort of bye-bye to our country.
You know, I am surprised at this point, among other things, that if I were a billionaire and if I were a capitalist, I would say, wait a minute, just as our patrician forebear Franklin Roosevelt and his patrician cousin forebear Teddy Roosevelt saved capitalism in the first half of the 20th century by understanding it had to be fairer and stabler and not just serving we rich people, you would think they would understand that rather than sending it over the falls toward God knows what, Venezuela, Chile. I mean, some bad Latin American model that we seem to be on the verge of becoming if we don't restore the basic degrees of equality and security and social mobility and all the rest that we had when you and I, Chris, were young people.
Kurt, go back to the other big strand in your book, which is the default to nostalgia. And especially in this convention time, Make America Great Again is about going backward. And Joe Biden is the past. I mean, he is not the bridge to anything. He is the end of an era of a certain class of politicians. How did that happen? It began, I suppose you are going to say, with Ronald Reagan, you know, morning in America again or something.
Well, there was some organic nostalgia plunge happening in reaction to the newness of the 60s, which became discombobulatingly new to a lot of Americans in the late 60s. In fact, a young political reporter in the New York Times in 1976 wrote a story that I quote without naming him, and that was you, sir, talking about the nostalgia and cynicism and apathy into which American voters were plunging in 1976.
Word. Be specific. I mean, we're talking remakes and sequels.
Well, we are talking at first, and I think it's an important first, in 1970, 71, 72, music like Sha Na Na, movies like American Graffiti, TV shows that are remaking American Graffiti like Happy Days, movies and plays like Grease. And what was so striking was this nostalgia for the time just before the 1960s. Hmm. As it happens, just before civil rights and equal rights for women. And of course, before the Vietnam War. So that was the first burst of nostalgia as a counter reaction to, oh my God, everything's so crazy and new in the late 60s. And then it spread to, oh, weren't the 40s beautiful? Weren't the old days of every description in America beautiful and better and more normal and more understandable and more coherent and more wonderful than we had starting the day before yesterday in the 60s? So that was a real thing and a kind of organic and spontaneous thing that the evil geniuses, the Reagan campaign, and Reagan himself understood how to use politically, how to, no, I'm just a good old cowboy. And wasn't America good and kind when we were all living in a small town?
Kurt Anderson's new book, Evil Geniuses, is one journalist's double take on the big woods that we missed when he and I were reporting American life tree by tree since the 1970s. Coming up, Ronald Reagan's path from playing TV's good guy from the past to the White House. This is Open Source. Kurt Anderson sees a nostalgic turn in American culture in the last half century or so. In his account, it rhymes with a broad conservative retreat from the heroic memory of Franklin Delano Roosevelt and from the civil rights movement too. And no voice gave more allure to that nostalgia than Ronald Reagan.
The Indian woman, Lena, returned to her own people and devoted her life to teaching them to improve their lot. She never remarried. Rumors of the rich Captain Dick mine spread throughout the mining country. Hundreds of prospectors searched for it. Gold was found by some of them, but as far as is known, no one ever found the Captain Dick mine. It has taken its place in the legends of the mining country.
That's the 40th president of the United States in his last showbiz gig before running for office. He was the TV host of the serial Death Valley Days.
Yes, indeed. The host often also starred in Death Valley Days episodes as the kindly sheriff or the good rancher or, you know, there he was during the 50s and 60s as a guy from the past, as a good guy from the past. And again, he was elected president, which began this kind of merger of show business with presidential politics. You know, television also obviously did that same thing. But here was this guy, this charming, winsome guy who was, even as he was turning into this political master of the right, playing a character, playing these likable American characters from the past. So there you had it. I won't say it was easy, but they did brilliantly use the kind of fictional American hero that Ronald Reagan played. And he became president. And at that point, the distinctions between the fiction and the fictions that Ronald Reagan had played and this reassuring plunge into nostalgia that Americans were indulging at the time when used it politically, just boom, so brilliantly, so evilly, and so geniusly.
Well, that's how the Great Turkey War was fought and won, by the First People's Government in the Pikes Peak Gold Rush Country. 2 years later, Colorado became a territory. In 1876, Colorado became the 38th state in the Union. As for Horace Greeley, he has a living monument in Colorado, the thriving city of Greeley, named for him, not far from where he panned gold in 1859.
And then along comes Restoration Hardware as the retailing model.
Well, yes, that's the thing. It became industrialized, the nostalgia industry of a kind we had never had in this country before. We had had, in fact, invented, one could argue, a certain kind of industrialized nostalgia, starting with Buffalo Bill back in the 1800s. But never had it been truly and literally industrialized to the extent that it was during the 80s and 90s in this country. Restoration Hardware being one of the examples I raise, where it was making people look back and sell them a version of the recent past, of their own past, or past they didn't have if they were too young to have actually experienced the 1940s and 50s.
Kurt Anderson, you make an interesting observation that, you know, 30s culture is immediately obviously different from 20s. The 40s have a totally different feel from the 30s. 50s, again, different. 60s. But to this point, 2020 culture looks a lot like 2010s culture, which look a lot like 90s culture. We've hit a certain stasis. How can that be? And how would you document what you mean?
That I looked at as its own thing and was struck by it a dozen years ago. I saw that it was connected. Not, again, that the nine guys in the room who had started meeting in the 70s also said, yes, and let's make culture stagnate so that life will seem both reassuring and unchanging, and it will make people believe that any radical fundamental change in politics and economics is also impossible because the culture isn't changing. I'm not suggesting that. However, I am suggesting that it happened for a variety of reasons, and has served the interests, the political interests, and the economic interests of the rich and of big business to make people feel as though, yeah, for all the changes and all the new technology, which obviously is new since then, nothing else really does ever change. The music will not fundamentally and crazily change, as you say, as it did every decade for most of modern life and most of certainly modern American life. Each decade seemed very different, and the last decade, as soon as the new one came along, seemed dated. Well, that stopped happening very much around 1990, just as the digital revolution happened and just as the economic evil geniuses succeeded in re-engineering our economy so that it served them as opposed to the 75 or 80% of Americans whom it didn't serve well. And it has continued serving them by making everybody think or feel as though, apart from the supercomputers we all carry in our pockets, nothing much really changes or can be changed very fundamentally. So what are you going to do?
Question, what does the digital transformation have to do with it that has so broadly diversified spokesmanship? Everybody's a podcaster now. We're all liberated to speak our mind. But is that somehow, or paradoxically, related?
It is related in many ways. I mean, it's related, for instance, in that the digital revolution and now AI going forward is going to keep making it harder and harder for this economic system of ours to create enough jobs that it makes economic sense to pay human beings to do. People of every political stripe, ideological stripe, who are economic experts say, nope, this time it's different. It's not going to be like it was in the previous industrial revolutions where it all sorted itself out because there were eventually enough jobs in factories to replace the people who came off the farms, and then enough jobs in offices to replace the people who we didn't need to be in factories any longer. This time, the machines, these brilliant machines of now and the future, are going to mean that there just aren't enough jobs that need to be done at a wage and a salary that make for decent lives for people to do. So what happens then? Thus, we're talking about universal basic incomes and what do we do now? But I think culturally too, you know, there are all kinds of ways in which the digital revolution fits into this, but this one of work and jobs and this how we distribute the wealth. And by the way, economic growth has continued and economic growth will continue again after this latest crisis.
With or without workers, right.
The pandemic. No, and even before the pandemic, it was amazing the degree to which when you talk to CEOs and executives quietly, anonymously or not, and they would admit, the more we can engineer the worker out of this equation, the better we'll be, the more money we, our company, will make. And thus, we can have a stock market that is right now almost at its historic high. So is unemployment at its historic high. Because by the way, workers, we don't need you or want you.
No, it's incredible. I'll come back to these hard money points. You say today the United States is the most unequal rich country on earth. You also collect data points or people that I thought only I knew. Dan Ariely, for example, and he did this incredibly interesting quiz for all sorts of people. But you show divisions of wealth in circles, and you say, would you want to live in this one where 1% owns 50, 60% of everything? Or would you like to live in this one where it's roughly proportional, the quintiles are almost even? 92% of the people say, no, I want to live in that one, which happens to be Sweden. And our political leaders keep warning us against, you know, you don't want Euro-socialism on these shores. Why not? Have we ever been offered it?
Right. And we're going to hear that at the Republican convention. Oh, no, don't do this socialism, these crazy socialism that the puppet Joe Biden is going to institute. Well, if only. First of all, Sweden, Norway, Denmark, Iceland, the Nordics, they are not socialist in any meaningful way. They have this social democracy, this social democratic welfare state, each in their own way, that makes their people, rich and middle and poor-ish, pretty happy. But they also, as the right, the intellectuals of the right, the think tanks of the right confess and concede, have among the freest free market systems on earth, as well as these generous social welfare states. So this idea that, no, don't go there, don't go to socialism, don't have more social security and healthcare and
free
and
higher education, are you
and
kidding?
Affordable or free higher education and all the rest, because, oh, you'll be Venezuela. No, you won't. You'll be Finland. You'll be Norway. You'll be Denmark. You'll be Canada, for God's sake, that does it better than we do, just north of the border. So here we are. And it just seems to me that if what we need is a kind of FDR recognition that, folks, this golden goose of a free market economy that we've had just isn't going to work unless you make most of its inhabitants and its workers and its citizens a lot happier and content and fairly treated as you've allowed them to be since this great shift, this great paradigm shift that you brought about 40 years ago happened.
There's a problem of understanding here, of just seeing the fact. I would have said that the 2020 season, including the Democratic debates last year, were a kind of truth time, and COVID has accentuated it. Black Lives Matter, George Floyd has emphasized it. We see the reality of slavery's track into our world much more clearly. Piketty reminds us of the obvious truth that money makes more money than work does. We see all sorts of other things, that we don't have a public health system. We're seeing the folly of American empire too. Very clearly, people get it. And yet at the same time, in the same people, a kind of denial. What's that about?
There is. Some of them don't realize, and it's complicated. It's so interestingly complicated and nuts. When I, for instance, recently, and I didn't really write about this in the book because I didn't want to make this book, Evil Geniuses, be so much about Trump as my last book, Fantasyland, was very much so, because he was the apotheosis of this craziness that has become QAnon and the rest. But I went back just the last few weeks and looked at Donald Trump's last big two-minute campaign commercial in 2016, in which, having campaigned on, I will give you a better healthcare, universal healthcare system, will cover everyone, than my opponent, this puppet of Wall Street, Hillary Clinton, would ever give you. And you look back to this ad that came out in October, that was his big final push and pitch, in which he demonizes Wall Street and bankers and Goldman Sachs and these rich manipulators of the system who have destroyed the working class and the wealth in America and taken it for themselves for their rigged system. It could have been, instead of Donald Trump doing this two-minute voiceover, Bernie Sanders. I'm telling you, that is not an exaggeration.
It's a global power structure that is responsible for the economic decisions that have robbed our working class, stripped our country of its wealth, and put that money into the pockets of a handful of large corporations and political entities. The only thing that can stop this corrupt machine is you.
That was his final pitch. He was going to take care of you, you white working class people who've been screwed by Wall Street. And of course, he didn't. And of course, the economic right, who have controlled and do dominate, and the Kochs and the rest, his party, the Republican Party, had no intention of it and had been clued in one way or another that this was just talk for the rubes to get elected. And now here they are warning that these Democratic capital D socialists might win. And oh my gosh, they ruin everything. It's just extraordinary because there he was campaigning on it. And don't some of his supporters remember that that's one of the reasons, in addition to the racism and the bigotry and the xenophobia that they were affirming, don't they remember that part of the reason they liked Donald Trump back in 2016 was that he wasn't one of these neoliberal Hillary Clinton people who never did anything for us? I guess they need to be reminded that that's one of the reasons they voted for this guy.
You can read your book and say, put a fork in it, it's over. And yet you have, there's a rainbow in your vision too. Make America new again, if I can give away the slogan. I love the way you work your parents and grandparents into it, but you say, going back to the 19th century, they remembered or were in touch with versions of this outrageous spot we're in 2020, this radical uncertainty that we're struggling with, and somehow things turned. Outline it.
Yeah, and by the way, I, this child of Nebraska Republicans and grandchild of Nebraska Republicans who were variously poor and then middle class and then upper middle class, I go back to 1914 and look at what was going on then, and obviously in the 1930s as well, but for that early 20th century period where things, when you look back at it, look back at the great historian, journalist Walter Lippmann's description of life in America and its tumult and volatility in 1914, as suddenly these corporate trusts didn't seem very trustworthy and the idea of government intervention to control them seemed a lot more appealing to a lot more people suddenly. And women were suddenly being given the vote and, oh my gosh, look at this. As, of course, was going on 100 years ago today. And it was all seemed to be coming apart at the seams. And look at what was about to happen in Russia, this communist revolution. And in America, however, unlike in Russia, we would make it through because we would embrace these new ways of doing capitalism to buffer it, that was sustainable, because we would have a central bank that was enlightened and would make it rational, and we would have minimum wages, and we would allow unions to grow and flourish and give workers power. And that's how, through the great Republican Teddy Roosevelt and then the great rich Democrat Franklin Roosevelt, and would create a New Deal after a depression had befallen us, to make it work, to make this free market system work, and to do this new kind of capitalism that would be, that would create a great middle class and all that. And we were still willing to go for it and to create, along with airplanes and cars and all these amazing technologies that were the digital revolution of their time, we would embrace that and we would come out of it. And of course, fight a war to defeat fascism as well. And we did. And the Greatest Generation was pretty great. And they did that and made life not only economically fairer, but racially somewhat fairer and so forth. And here we are, the McCarthyites of our time, who the Republicans like my parents and grandparents of the time in the 50s and 60s quashed and didn't let take over their party for very long. And now those nuts, what my conservative Republican father back in the 60s used to call the black hats, the crazies who lived across the street. For instance, one of the people who literally lived across the street were the Lamps, the kind of Republicans they didn't like. And of course, the Lamps were the parents of Ginny Lamp, who is now one of these Trumpists and married, of course, to Clarence Thomas, the Supreme Court Justice, who is also the epitome of this kind of extreme right. But we got through it, right? We did get through the dangerous possibilities that might have befallen us in the teens and the 20s and the 30s and did with the Depression. And we could have gone communist and we could have gone fascist, but we didn't. We stayed progressively free market. But now here we are, and it's one of those inflection points again, where it could all go to crap, or we could win again. We could manage that the forces of forward-looking newness could triumph once again.
Coming up, this so-called inflection point that so many people say we are at. This is Open Source. In Kurt Anderson's new book, The Wilting of New Deal Principles, The Thinning Air of Equality in a Shared Fate, doesn't have to be the last chapter. He sees a new generation just off the American main stage and many alternative models in the wider world.
Well, it's kind of double or triple or quadruple or nothing. I mean, here we are, where we have turned ourselves into this desperately unequal, unnecessarily unequal, and insecure economy, where 75% or more of our fellow Americans have not done well, do not do well, and have a sense of hopelessness for their children and their grandchildren that we didn't used to have. So we can just get back to square one, like it was when Joe Biden entered the Senate, and like he imagines by cooperating with this party that has become the fantasy party, the stupid party, the crazy person party, run by the CEOs and the rich. It's either we've lost it and we will become a choose your Latin American horror show, Venezuela, Argentina, whatever, a country that is unequal and oligarchical and run by the plutocrats, or we will politically change course to get back a little more fairness or a lot more fairness like we used to have. And as technology takes us into some, you say, rainbow, as a future that can be pretty great and prosperous if we are sharing our wealth equally, and as this new extraordinary technology makes it possible for fewer and fewer people to have to work, and the wealth and plenty and bounty is shared as we go forward into this techno AI future. Andy Grove, the inventor, the founder of Intel, and one of the pioneers of so much of our technological present, said inflection points are the place where you go bust and go bad and it all goes to hell, or you go to undreamed of heights. That's where we are. That's where we were as I was finishing this book before the pandemic. That's where we were with this choice, this inflection point. We can either make America great again, truly great, by embracing the new in all of its extraordinary ways in this new multicultural land of ours and population of ours and wondrous technologies of ours, or we can sink into a kind of digital feudalism where we just look back at old videos of music the way it was and life the way it was and dream, oh, wasn't it great back in the past? That's our choice. And we have one party that has gotten so crazily involved in restoring an impossible to restore past. And we've got another party that maybe, if we allow its youth to take it where it needs to go and take us as a country where we need to go, to have a country that is once again embracing the new.
There's a strange vertigo that comes with this moment. I mean, the Democrats in their convention have sort of summed up their recent past in all its inglorious compromises, the war in Iraq, tax cuts to the end of time, this sort of thing. But the future is standing there off stage, not so much Bernie as the young people who supported him in 16 and in bigger numbers in 2020. But Andrew Yang, for my money, is a marvelous prevision of a recovered smart country. AOC for sure, the Green New Deal, Black Lives Matter, all over the place. And we have some extraordinary representatives of that wave. It's ready to move. When does it get a chance to take the field? And who will we know that they're up to it?
I mean, the necessary thing, but not the sufficient thing, is to get rid of this most grotesque version of this rightist party that we now have. And that is, as I say, necessary, but not sufficient to get there. So, you know, you get a big landslide, God willing, in which the main villain is thrown out. And we'll see about the rest of his, how many of the rest of his villainous enablers are thrown out. And then we see, and it's going to be a long slog. That will be, if that happens, when it happens, whether it's November 4th or December 4th or January 4th, we'll see. And that's the beginning where we see a Democratic Party that will have to do what the Democratic Party did in 1933 to get us out of the hellishness that we're in now, just as it did get us out of the hellishness that we were in then, and see where we go. I mean, you know, what happened back then before our time in the 30s was not, oh, let's go back to the way it was. That's exactly what it was fighting, right? That's what the New Deal was fighting. No, we are not going back to the way it was. We're going to this future, this terrifying future with this new immigrant America and creating a new America. And that's what we called it, the New Deal. And if you want to call it the Green New Deal now, fine, but it's got to be going forward. And it's got to be what will feel pretty radical for a while because of this weaponized nostalgia of the last 40 or 50 years that has made us so terrified of daring to go forward. No, we can't have something so crazy and new. Well, I hate to tell you, but there's no other choice. And we'll see. And the first step, of course, is having a non-crazy bunch of grown-ups and young grown-ups in charge, or the forces of money and darkness in charge. And it really, and again, as you know, Chris, I mean, I have not been that kind of hyperbolic thinker or talker for my long life.
That's what makes your book so interesting, Kurt. I've never thought of you, and I don't think of you now, as a bomb thrower or as a wacko or a particularly political guy. You're a Moby Dick guy. You're a culture guy. You're a radio guy. You're a journalist of the first water, but one of us. And suddenly, out of the mouths of a Harvard man comes this very liberating candor and numbers and research. I want to come back to the people who are half aware of the incredibly precarious time, and they're watching or aggressively not watching these conventions or watching with a sort of glazed stare. What's the Kurt Anderson program? Here's what I copied out to remember. Resetting the balance of power in a big way in favor of the majority, of the people, that is, citizens and employees, as you write, versus big business and the rich. That must be the overriding goal. What's the first step to it?
Well, the first step is making as many people understand that their interests are not those of the wealthy. I have done well, and that's one of the ways that I didn't realize that this vast majority of my fellow citizens were not doing well was because I was doing well, because the rich and powerful were allowing me enough of their leftovers to do well, right? And so we need to make a solid majority of American voters understand that they have the political power in a democracy, as long as we stay a democracy, to make this country fair again, fairer, and fairer, God willing, than it ever was.
Right.
Then let's, for instance, look around the world and see how it's done elsewhere. So much better in so many ways than we have been doing it.
Who's your model country out there?
Well, there are a bunch of model countries. And by the way, this crazy discussion that Democrats had about which form of universal health care we should have, there are a whole bunch of ways to skin that cat. And the rest of the rich world, whether it's Canada or Britain or Germany or Australia or the Nordic countries, do it in a million different ways. So let's look at how they do it. They're all models in their way. And they all, for instance, give parental leave when people have children in order to encourage them to have children and be able to have children and come back to work. That's one thing, and universal health care and affordable education and all the rest. There's no one model countries. I mean, the country of my great grandparents, Denmark, and before that, Norway, do it pretty well. But, you know, as I say, Canada does it pretty well as well. Right north of Michigan, right north of New York. They do it pretty well as well, better than we do. So there are a bunch of model countries. But Louis Brandeis, the great Supreme Court justice, the great antitrust movement celebrator, had this great thing he said in one of his decisions about this laboratory of democracy that we have in the United States. Where
The anvils of democracy, the way he described the state.
Yes.
Right?
And let's see how that state does it or this state. Well, we are now a global world. So let's see how that country does it and that country does it. The way the rest of the world used to look to us, the United States, to, wow, look at this democracy they've done. Look at how they've done it there. Well, there are a lot of countries in which so many parts of the system, the way you set up an economy, the way you have politics work, is done better elsewhere. So let's look at those places and not imagine that we in the United States are the only people who know how to do it well. So there's that. Or look at Alaska. At the end of the book, I talk about Andrew Yang, who you mentioned, and I think did a marvelous thing running for president by putting this idea of universal basic income and social wealth and all the rest on the table in a way that was very respectfully received by media and people.
Yeah.
Alaska has done that extraordinarily well for the last 50 years with their Alaska Permanent Fund, which, thanks to their essentially socialist expropriation by Republicans of a portion of the fossil fuel wealth that was discovered in that state 50-odd years ago, they send a couple of $3,000-$4,000 to every man, woman, and child in Alaska every year as a fraction of that oil money. So they've established the principle, right? They've established that principle of social wealth. And let's send a couple of $1,000s, or sometimes some years when they're doing well, a few $1,000s to every Alaskan. Well, that's an interesting principle in this libertarian, Republican, free market state.
I was going to say, did Sarah Palin approve of all that?
She not only approved of it, Chris, she inherited it as governor, as something one of her Republican predecessors had established, and then upped it, taxed the oil companies more in order to give more Alaskans, including her and her large family, many thousands of tens of thousands of dollars in the case of the Palin family a year. What her party at every whip stitch calls socialist, like they did Medicare before it was enacted, like they did Social Security before it was enacted, is the Alaskan miracle. Look at, and by the way, Alaska 50 years ago, before they had this little modest universal basic income, was down at the bottom of the most economically unequal states in America. Today, they're up always at one or two of the most equal states in America. Look at that, would you? It hasn't made them work less. It has made, in fact, in some cases, because if you get a few thousand dollars more a year as an Alaskan family in the bank account, that means you can afford childcare and you as an Alaskan woman might be able to go out and work. And indeed, that's what's happened there. So that's just one example of, as soon as we stop defaulting to, no, look at socialism about whatever it is, that, for instance, we can figure out non-doctrinaire ways to have a better, more content, more equal, more fair society, you know?
You've covered a lot of politics. I've covered politics all my life.
Not as much as you, but I've
covered but I mean a lot. What's wrong with our politics? And I'm thinking specifically of this Democratic season. open it up to endless debates all over the place and a variety of primaries, 20 candidates to begin with, and it was kind of an interesting range of people. Bernie did well out of the gate. Elizabeth Warren did well. Bernie stayed strong. Andrew and others made it interesting. Trot along to February and March. February, Bernie seemed to be inside of the nomination. Suddenly, COVID is here. South Carolina primary is sort of in the bag, we all knew, for Joe Biden. Bernie wins in California. But suddenly, the lights go out, and Joe Biden is deemed the inescapable choice. Bernie and Elizabeth are gone, but with them is gone the whole idea of a wealth tax, which they both endorsed. And Michael Bloomberg almost openly was in the race to block it. He looked at Bernie at one point, he said, Bernie, it's called communism, and it didn't work. And the net was a kind of moderately interesting show for a while, interesting participation, and back to unmistakably yesterday's guy. Maybe safe, but maybe vulnerable. What has happened to our sort of putting on a multiple horse race and seeing who can run convincingly and bring in the new voters, the new issues, and move forward?
Well, the thing I did whenever I looked at polls during the Democratic primary season, I would add up the essentially, hold on there, centrist candidates and their collective vote, and Bernie and Elizabeth and Andrew Yang. I looked at those three versus the rest, basically. And the rest always had the majority. They just did. For whatever set of reasons, most Democrats wanted to vote for Biden or Buttigieg or Klobuchar or all those people who weren't Elizabeth Warren and Bernie Sanders and Andrew Yang. So the Democrats did, for whatever set of reasons, decide to go that way. Now, part of that reason was like, I don't know, we got to be careful. We still got to be careful. We got to win the election. And some of it was they didn't buy economic progressivism, whatever set of reasons, but that was true. So it was not stolen from my candidate, Elizabeth Warren. That other side won. Okay, there we are. So I always say, okay, I'm a half glass full person. And I say, okay, well, if Joe Biden is the nominee, then certainly the chance of having a definitive landslide victory by having nominated generic Democrat is there. So let's go for that and hope that he understands, as I hope and believe he does, that his party is now maybe almost half Yang, Warren, Sanders, and some of that other part that were for him and Klobuchar and whatever can be convinced, because maybe they were just on that side because they were crossing their fingers and wanted to win and didn't think a lefty could. I don't think he's anti, he's God knows now, not anti-public option on healthcare. So I think he'll read the wins. And if he's going to be FDR, and he's talked about himself in that sense, I'm hopeful if he's elected and if they're elected, where they'll go, and that they won't put, you know, former Wall Street CEOs in charge of their economic program again, as Barack Obama did and as Bill Clinton had before him. We'll see. No doubt we'll be disappointed, but I don't expect to be. If the Democrats win, if this ticket wins, I think the party center of gravity has moved considerably on economics to the left. And for that, I'm happy and hopeful, knock wood. Okay, we've ended up with Joe Biden, but I don't think that's so terrible. And by the way, as a guy who actually is old enough to have been around and actually have a lived experience of powerful unions, that's not so bad. And lived in a union household where his dad was a blue-collar worker, that's not so bad, as long as he isn't fooled into thinking that unions still have much power right now, or that the Republicans are a party that he can do much business with the way you could in the 70s and 80s when there were liberal Republicans, you know? So I don't know. I'm hopeful about where we can go politically. You just have to do this first thing first that, you know, has to be done in 2 months, a little over 2 months.
Kurt Anderson, I'm encouraged that enough people are going to read your book to be scared straight. I mean, the picture of our economy is devastating, a real warning that we're in deepest trouble, and yet your good old Nebraskan cheer comes through. Make America new again. I can't thank you enough.
My pleasure.
Kurt Anderson's book is called evil geniuses. Please think of supporting Open Source. The best way is by becoming a monthly subscriber on Patreon, where you will find extras like Adam Coleman's ongoing series of interviews about storytelling in a time of social distance. This week, he talks with The Simpsons writer and showrunner Mike Reese about the show's prediction 20 years ago of a Trump presidency. Find that conversation at patreon.com/radioopensource. Our show this week was produced by Connor Gillies and Adam Coleman. Mike Garth engineered it. Mary McGrath is our unevil genius. I'm Christopher Lydon. Join us next time. Join us every time for Open Source.